From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. This hour, we celebrate Black History Month with two African-American musicians who will be performing in Iowa this week. First, we talk with saxophonist and jazz musician Ray Blue. This evening, Ray Blue will perform at the Des Moines Public Library. Then a conversation with folk artist Vance Gilbert. Several of Gilbert's songs deal with racial issues, and his live show banter often touches on the fact that he is a black man in a field of music dominated by both white performers and audiences. Vance Gilbert will be performing Friday evening at CSPS in Cedar Rapids. We get started in just a few minutes. First, a look at this hour's news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour we mark Black History Month with two African-American musicians who are in Iowa this week. Later in the hour, a conversation with folk artist Vance Gilbert. But first, jazz musician and saxophonist Ray Blue. Blue performs regularly at jazz festivals and has worked with dozens of jazz greats. He's a graduate of the University of Iowa, as well as William Penn University, which annually presents the Ray Blue Jazz Award to a graduating senior. Blue is also an educator. He consults at colleges, universities, schools, and communities around the world. Founder of the Cross Cultural Connection, Inc. That's a jazz performance and educational organization that promotes the music in educational and community institutions and theaters. Ray Blue is in Iowa this week, making appearances around the state. Last night, he performed at Mount Mercy College in Cedar Rapids. Tonight, he was to appear at the Des Moines Public Library. Because of our weather, though, that has been postponed until February 24th. So folks who were planning to turn out at the Des Moines Public Library to see Ray Blue tonight, that has been postponed because of our weather to February 24th. On Thursday of this week, he'll be at Buena Vista University in Storm Lake, and Friday in the Iowa City and North Liberty area. Ray Blue joins me this morning. He got through the snow in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Ray, thanks for coming out in the snow.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Mount Mercy was the site of your performance yesterday, the latest project you have called Music of Change. You performed this last night, a real interesting multimedia event, live music, slides, narration. Tell us about it.
Well, Music of Change came about, it conceptualized just a year ago. My partner and the writer of the script, author James Culver Jr., and I had done some workshops together. And being on the same page with regard to that type of theme, it came together rather quickly. So James did the he wrote the script, and I wrote and arranged the music, and we moved forward from there.
Mm-hmm. So, what specific awareness about African American music and its roots do you want to raise with this project that you don't feel is well understood?
Well, it's not so much the music being needed to be explained. It's really an American story. It's a story about the evolution of the African American community, and through all the adversities and the situations and conditions, the community has continued to survive and thrive and move forward.
Mm-hmm. So, what part does jazz play in the development of the African American community?
Well, jazz came from our community. It was initiated in our community. As I say, you know, it's an American story. And jazz in itself, due to the social conditions, was really nurtured in the African American community. There was no integration, you know, legally, and therefore, we stayed amongst ourselves, and it had to, and the music was nurtured that way, in our communities. It went outside eventually when it was seen to be commercial. You know, of commercial value, but for the most part, non-black musicians and patrons came into the African American community to listen and to study and to play the music.
And sometimes they sort of snuck into the scene because earlier in the 20th century, it was an unseemly art form.
Yes, it was considered, there were different terms put on it, but it was considered race music. Mm-hmm. And, something that had to do with those uncivilized people. But that was part of the ignorance of the times or the thinking of the times, as we know.
We want to. You brought along some music. We wanted to take a listen to your saxophone work in this ensemble. We have a piece. Let's listen to it, but tell us about it before we do. I guess it's just past the noon hour. This is titled Berries for Breakfast. I think we can still have berries for breakfast. Tell us about it before we hear this.
Well, that's a title cut from my new CD, my newest CD, and we're in the pre-release phase of it right now. Berries and Blues is the name of the CD, and the title it came about very simply because both elements are good for you.
Okay, very good. Who's besides you on the saxophone? Who's playing in this ensemble?
On piano, I have Tom McClung. On bass, Eric Jacot. He's from Paris. Douglas Sides on drums. Rasul Sadiq, trumpet. Now, all of these players are expats who live in Paris.
Mm-hmm. And was recorded in Paris?
Yes, that was recorded in Paris.
Okay, let's take a little listen to this. Is Berries for Breakfast featuring saxophonist Ray Blue and company. Work of my guest, saxophonist Ray Blue, a number of other musicians. Berries for Breakfast, the title of that tune, off his the cover title, tune from your latest CD. Is that right,
yes,
Ray?
Yes, it is, man.
That sure makes me want to get up in the morning. It reminds me of a quote that you have on your website by Johnny Griffin. Jazz is music made by and for people who have chosen to feel good in spite of conditions.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you wake up to jazz?
Sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes. Well, I'm always hearing it in my head, and I'm told that I play my saxophone in my sleep, so I guess I do wake up to it. Yeah.
Uh-huh. We want to hear another piece, Softly as in a Morning Sunrise. We have a break coming up, but we can hear it going into this break. Tell us about this piece. Why did you pick this one?
Well, this is a standard. It was done. This was recorded in New York from my previous CD. And that CD entitled Transvision was one that's dedicated to friendships. And the arrangement is one that I adapted from a friend from South Africa, a bassist. His name is Eddie Eusta. And this is the way that we approach the tune playing with him. Mm-hmm. And I like the tune, and the band itself is amazing anyway. Calvin Hill, Michael Cochran, Bruce Cox, Doug Williams.
And any specific challenges you ran into this interpretation of Softly as in a Morning Sunrise?
The challenges, what are always musical challenges, but I don't think it was anything totally unusual. It was great chemistry amongst the musicians. The band, that had been my band at the time, and we'd been working together, and so it came together, I think, in one take in the studio. So that
okay,
was
what year? How long ago was this recorded?
That was 06.
Okay, this is from 2006. Ray Blue and a number of other performers playing Softly as in a Morning Sunrise. When we come back, we'll talk more with Ray Blue. Last night, he performed at Mount Mercy College in Cedar Rapids. Tonight, his presentation that was scheduled for the Des Moines Public Library has been postponed to February 24th. He'll be at in Storm Lake on Thursday, in Iowa City and North Liberty on Friday. Let's listen to Ray Blue and Company, Softly as in a Morning Sunrise. We'll be back after a short break following the music. Jazz musician Ray Blue with me this morning in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City, making several appearances across the state, not only as a musician, performer, but also as an educator. We want to listen to some more of his music a little bit before he has to go away at the half past the hour. But before we do that, tell us more, Ray Blue, about the educational side of your work. I was interested to see on your website that your junior high school music teacher introduced his class to Kind of Blue by Miles Davis,
yes.
proclaiming, "This is your music."
Mm-hmm.
And that was a turning point of sorts for you.
Yeah. Well, that teacher happened to be an Italian American who had a horrible English accent, you know, Mr. Taviano. And he's a naturalized citizen and a marvelous musician and educator, obviously. When he said your music, he was talking to us about it being American classic music, and that was something very special. You know, here we are, 12-year-old boys, It was good. He said, "All right," and just coming in after the lunch break, "sit down and shut up. You're gonna listen to this, you know." And bingo.
So it was as if to say, if you were in Europe, you say, "We know classical music comes from Europe, but yeah, this is your music," and you had not realized it until he said that. Really.
Well, it had never been expressed to me in a school setting like that. Hmm. You know, and I was a seventh grader, my first year in middle school, and that was a great way to be orientated to music appreciation in that educational setting. It was great.
So when you are educating at colleges, universities, various community organizations around the country, around the world, what is the thrust of the points, the education you want to get across, the awareness you want to raise?
Well, firstly, is that we want to become the most productive human beings that we can be. Okay, that's the first thing, because we're people first, and music is what we do, radio work is what we do. Okay, it's important to make a commitment to acknowledge our responsibility to ourselves and to the commitment that we've made. It's important that students work very hard. I think it's very important to get across to them that they need to be good listeners. The process of learning how to learn has a lot to do with how we learn how to listen, and so that we're willing to receive information. It's important to trust oneself, and then we can trust others. The educators, the people that are imparting information to them, they need to be able to trust them so that they – and it's a two-way street there. And that's the challenge with educators. Our biggest challenge is to help students feel that they can trust us. Mm-hmm. And then they're open to receive the information, you know, more willingly.
You regularly perform on numerous world stages with musicians from many different cultures, mm-hmm, throughout Europe, throughout the world. Your wife is from Finland, so you're a multicultural person. You have residences both in New York City and in Berlin. I'm wondering, how is jazz received or celebrated, enjoyed differently in other parts of the world when we compare it with how it's treated in its land of origin?
Well, for a long time, it's been viewed and received in a much more receptive way outside of our country. I think after the swing era, it began to, and a lot of musicians particularly black musicians, went to other countries because they didn't have to deal with the race issue, right, as it was part of the American issue. But how it's received now, it's received differently. We're not received with open arms as it used to be.
No.
Simply because, and it's a human condition, meaning other countries, have had this music in their conservatories and schools for a number of years, and they study and they work very hard at it. Therefore, they have a scene now, and they have a way of communicating this music based on their culture. Okay. We hear the drum different than Europeans do. Africans hear the drum different than we do.
Describe that a little more precisely.
Well, our culture. Our cultures are different. For instance, Germany. It's a marching culture. If you listen to German music, traditional German music or classic German music, it's a marching music. You know, it's on the one.
More predictable.
Yeah. Well, more predictable, but it's more of a straight... You know, it's on the ours moves on the 2 and the 4, even though the strong beats are 1 and 3. We dance on the 2 and the 4. Uh-huh. Okay, we clap on the 2 and the 4, and you know, you've been in Europe, everything's
right
up front. Okay, so that's just an indication of how they hear rhythm, and how they feel rhythm. So and there's nothing bad about it. It's just what it is. It's a little different. So their concept of how things are done rhythmically. And melodies are only rhythms with intervals, okay. So there's a feel there, and that's where it moves forward from there. Ideas, they have everyone has their own interpretation, and that's the beauty of art. It's moving into another way because what came before us is not going to be reinvented. Okay, those that came before us, they came and they gave us some great great stuff, you know, all of it. You know, they came and they left, and they left these things that we're studying from, and it's been built upon what came before them. And now the newer generations, the younger generations are taking it to another place.
In 2003, you made your first trek to South Africa.
Yes.
As an educator and performer, in what way did that change you, open your eyes?
I went to the motherland, man. It was something, as an African-American, man, to step foot on the African continent it's really special. That's just the truth, because our history has been one. Our history here has been one in which we've been encouraged not to connect with that part of who we are. But it was a very special place for me, and I was there for music anyway, and so it just continued to grow within me.
Okay, before we go into this last piece, a little piece we wanted to play from you. I think a Duke Ellington composition that we'll hear a recording of. Is jazz's future in the more approachable, traditional-sounding jazz music, or with the more experimental, avant-garde art music? Does it belong in a concert hall or in a club?
It belongs in all venues. One of my mentors is Ornette Coleman. You know, so that in itself speaks volumes. You know, if you've ever heard Ornette's music, it belongs anywhere people want to hear it. You know, I think it needs to be exposed there. Traditionally, I think young people are learning. They're learning quickly. I think they need more time to develop. You know, before you know the higher accolades are placed upon them. But there are a lot of great young musicians. You know, they're being trained well. They got a lot of information, and I just hope they keep their heads and ears open.
Okay, Ray Blue, it's been fantastic that you could come through the snow to be with us today.
Thank you, Ben.
And I hope you have the rest of your time. It's snowy; it will be, but an enjoyable time in Iowa to your various points and your various presentations.
I know it will be.
Okay, very good. Let's go out with "In a Sentimental Mood." You're featured here on the saxophone, a composition by Duke Ellington.
Yes.
The other performers on this recording?
On this recording, it's Kenny Martin on drums. He's out of I recorded this one in Berlin. Kenny Martin's out of New York. Ralph Zilke is a great pianist in Berlin, and Martin Lilish on bass.
Okay, Ray Blue, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you too, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, a conversation with folk artist Vance Gilbert. Vance Gilbert will be performing Friday evening at CSPS in Cedar Rapids. Let's listen to a little more of Ray Blue with this Duke Ellington composition, In a Sentimental Mood. We'll be back in just a moment with more of The Exchange. Welcome back to The Exchange. I'm Ben Kiefer. Vance Gilbert burst onto the singer-songwriter scene in the early 1990s when the buzz started spreading in the folk clubs of Boston about an ex-multicultural arts teacher and jazz singer who was knocking them dead at open mics. Word spread to New York, and Sean Colvin invited Gilbert to be a special guest on her Fat City tour, and soon Gilbert took audiences across the country by storm. Vance Gilbert performs Friday night at CSPS in Cedar Rapids in support of his latest album called Up on Rockfield. I spoke with Vance Gilbert a few days ago. He told me that each song on this new album is penned as if he were co-writing with some of his musical heroes. Before we get to my conversation with Gilbert, here's a bit of one of the cuts on the new record. It's called Sweetwater.
Water casts light, leaning up against a new fishing sign. Cops go by, don't pay him no mind, like it's always been that way. Sweetwater got that name, cause when he drop his hook, the fish come run. Now he's got this much bird spot, and he'll work it the rest of the day. Every once in a while, some uninformed child will make fun of his crippled right hand. Child, smack the young one upside the back of his head, say, don't you get it? Sweetwater, throw out a line. Show me how you do your day to day. Sweetwater.
Well, Sweetwater, there's always stories spinning around in my head anyway, and I'm looking for a way to put them out and make some sense. The album, Up on Rockfield, is an assemblage of tunes that I wrote, but I wrote the tunes as if I was somebody else. So each one of the tunes is backdrop in that way. It's not that I'm trying to perform the songs as these people that I admire, but I'm actually trying to get the feel of the writing. And I had a lot of fun with Sweetwater. It's a imagine Al Jarreau and New Riders of the Purple Sage or somebody trapped in a room together in a snowstorm, and this is what they came up with, sort of a country-ish kind of thing with a very soulful vocal on the top of it. And I went out to tell a story. Now, Sweetwater is a guy that I wasn't necessarily painting him as black, but I guess in my mind's eye, I guess he is. He's a Korean War veteran and a bit of a sage, as you find out, in the midst of the song, or not. He shows you a portion of his life and makes you the sage, which I think is the key to writing a good song, is have the listener come to terms with what is the material, as opposed to beating them over the head with what's going on. And Sweetwater ends up being your inadvertent hero, which is repeated, you know, in a lot of storytelling context from all kinds of cultures. And with all this, that melange of stuff ends up being what Sweetwater is.
Is Sweetwater taken from an actual person, from the news, perhaps?
No, really not. It's an amalgam of maybe older individuals from my family that I remember, or from where I spent my summers on the shores of Maryland. These old fishermen that, you know, would be 80 years old at this point, but he's a mix of those people, not anybody in particular.
Vance, you started off as a jazz musician and then switched to more of a folky sound, though you do have jazz elements in your present music. Why did you make this switch?
Because the folk people were listening to the story, and maybe because I really wasn't that great a jazz singer. I mean, I was singing in a couple of places, doing the cocktail thing, and it was what it was. You know, I needed to tell a story, and I needed to tell a story my way. And the best way to do that is for an audience that is more apt to extract a story from the music. Because I think first and foremost, I always have been a storyteller. And I really didn't think, save for a handful of pieces, and I didn't really think jazz for me was telling the kind of story I needed to tell. I mean, I don't mean to disparage. There are great, great jazz storyteller writers out there, like Billy Strayhorn was a phenomenal jazz storytelling writer with Sophisticated Lady and Lush Life. It told really definitive stories. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. But I needed to be able to pull as much from the swinging soulfulness of the jazz idiom as I did need to pull from the storytelling sensibilities of the child ballads from England. So this acoustic folk scene was the best place to do that, and I'm still confused, and I hope you are too.
How was that for you as a black man entering a field of music dominated by both white performers and audiences?
Well, you know, it was double edged. Of I never tend to be without work in February.
Black History Month,
and everybody hires me. I'm playing everything from Ku Klux Klan picnics, everything. Everybody hires
no,
me.
No, that's a joke. Yeah.
Yeah, of course it is.
Yeah,
but that's part of what I do too. I also bring a certain amount of comedy to the fray here because a lot of my mentors coming up, a lot of people I listened to were the comedians and great sense of timing, and that's not that much of an anomaly to have folk musicians and comedians together. George Carlin and Kenny Rankin did that for years, and Jay Leno with Bonnie Raitt, and these people traveled, did a lot of work together. But you know, as a black man doing this music, I think I brought a different perspective. And that's also not to say that there haven't been black people doing this, as Josh White Jr. and Tracy Chapman and Keb Moe, and the list does kind of go on and on. However, I think in the thick of the acoustic singer-songwriter thing right now, I'm kind of your guy, I suppose.
In fact, a few years ago, you opened several shows for George Carlin, and you also like to banter with the audience. What do you like to talk with the audience about? Non-musically.
Anything. Well, anything, really. I become, I guess, somewhat Cosby-ish when it comes to my banter with the audience. I draw from the life experience of the day and from music itself. I try to tie it in from one song to the other. Sometimes it does indeed spring from the brow of Zeus, and I'll just come up with something that's a little bit, from the left field. But you know what I owe people when they spend money to come out, I feel like I owe them a sort of quadraphonic hit. They need to hear great songs sung well, and they need those songs to be strung together with good storytelling. And I also need to play guitar well, and that is the four cornerstones of delivering a legacy.
Well, let's listen.
What this is all about.
Well, let's listen to go back to some music and listen to some great songwriting, a great story. One of your cuts off this latest CD. Up on Rockfield is the CD. Let's listen to Judge's House. Tell us about this one before we do.
At Judge's House was another exercise for me, and I have no trouble saying to the public at large that I really was writing and using exercises to get me to do what I needed to do. It was my attempt to write a song that sounded as much like a Bruce Springsteen song as possible. Growing up as a kid, I wasn't a fan of Bruce Springsteen's or a lot of the sort of rock music of the time. I was in my own little brought up in Philadelphia black racist way. I just thought all that music was the antithesis of what I would want to listen to. I was into pop soul kind of thing, and I didn't want to be bothered with the E Street Band. And you know, I think what brought me across was finally hearing Bob Dylan as it came out of the mouth of Roberta Flack. And then I started working backwards, and I went out and picked up Blood on the Tracks and the Nebraska album and got to understand that there was more to music than finger popping down the street. So this was my attempt at writing a song that maybe wouldn't sound quite so absent on a Bruce Springsteen album.
Okay, here's Judge's House from Vance Gilbert's latest album, the album Up on Rockfield. Vance Gilbert, my guest. He'll be appearing at CSPS in Cedar Rapids on this Friday, February 12th. Judge's House. Let's listen to a little bit of it.
It's 4 o'clock in the morning on this side of town. Lonely dog barking is the only other sound. Sitting in my car outside this judge's house, 10 years to the day that he brought his gavel down. 10 years ago, but I recall it like it was yesterday. A man remembers when you take 10 years of his life away. Judge lives here on this side of town, where the grass is greener, driveways a long life memory. They go on and on and on and on and on.
So Judge's House, a comment on justice or injustice in the country, disparities in these in the country?
Yes. Finish your list. Go write down.
That's all I have.
You know, I don't come out with a list of things that I'm hoping to address. I really wanted to tell a little piece of a story. And one of the things that I was so proud of with Judge's House is the ending with the roses and such. I had no idea that was coming. I basically left myself open to whatever 1-2 punch the song was going to give me. And that was immensely frightening. That was so frightening to write like that because I didn't know where it was going to go. And I was really surprised at the humanity that came out of the song and the forgiveness. I felt maybe there was, if not hope for all of us, at least hope for me.
So this is a story, to recap, this is a story of a man, some alcohol involved, a little girl getting off a school bus, being hit, killed, I suppose?
I guess so. I think so, yeah. And then he finds the judge's address, and there he is outside, being very contemplative, and that is the song. It's him out there playing the past, playing his present, and playing his future a bit.
Minus 10 years of his life and the reflection that comes with that.
Indeed.
Well, I'd like to go back to a previous album of yours and one of your most popular tunes, Unfamiliar Moon, from the album of that same name. Tell us about this one.
That came out of a friend telling me in the midst of her divorce that as she came home, particularly the evening after leaving court, everything seemed that the steps going up, the whole approach to her same front door was different than she'd ever imagined it would be now that her marriage was over. And I just ran with that. And I think I came up with a song that many people could identify with. I guess what I should say is I came up with it with a sensibility and a sentiment that many can identify with, and that was the root of that song altogether.
Are you often surprised when you have these universal themes that you tap into with individual stories in songs, the interpretation that people put in on them?
Am I surprised at other people's interpretations?
That they can be so far from perhaps your original one.
Well, I guess I am. I end up being surprised. I end up feeling humble because I never thought that something that I would write could be construed in as many ways as people might. And when people tell me what they hear, I basically have to bow to them and say thank you very much. You just never know, and I guess it's part and parcel to even thinking that you might be a success at what you're doing, that people find various ways to connect to it.
So let's listen to Unfamiliar Moon off the album of the same name by my guest, Vance Gilbert.
Those are the words I know. The melody's all wrong, but the DJ says that's how it goes. Like a child.
Vance, I'm wondering, did you grow up in a musical household? What did you listen to?
Those are two different questions. My household wasn't really musical. My mom sang in the church choir and did so pretty badly, but she did indeed. And my dad, one of the things I didn't know he could do until later in life was that he could actually play the harmonica. Other than that, there really wasn't much in the way of musical ability in the house. However, we did have a turntable, and there were a lot of records spinning, particularly on the weekends. There was, as I was growing up, there was a lot of Motown and the pop songs of the day from my brother, and that would be in the 60s. And my parents, when they were spinning their albums, there would be quite a bit of Ray Charles and Dakota Staton and Dinah Washington and the sort of jazz pop people, the Beyoncés and Lady Gagas of their day, you know what I mean? And that was pretty much what I'd listened to until I started making my own little pennies and buying my own 45s. Oh, my God, I'm so old. Did I say 45s?
45.
I did.
I remember them too, Vance. We're all old.
Man. Oh. Yeah, so that was it. I started buying my own 45s and taking magic marker and writing my name around the center of them and so that I wouldn't mix them up with my brother, who occasionally had duplicates of what I had, or if I took them as I became a teenager to a party to listen to so I could get them back. And those were the days.
Well, this has been a great pleasure to talk with you, Vance Gilbert. I wanted to go out with one more song. Here, you mentioned the church choir that your mother sang poorly at by, I think, her admission or your admission?
In retrospect, I think I could viably say that, God rest her soul, but yeah, it was, sorry.
You have a great gospel.
People are listening and saying, he's disrespecting his mother on the radio. I say, look, dude, it just wasn't that good, okay?
If we could, I'd like to go out with a cut from your new CD. This is Some Great Thing, a great gospel tune. You pulled in an organ for this, and it's a song that you wrote for a friend's funeral?
Yes. Someone asked me to write this song as I was driving to the funeral. They were asking for something more in line with Precious Lord, Take My Hand, and I just kind of winced because I really didn't know. I didn't know that, and I said, "Well, I'll come up with something similar, and don't you worry." And out came the pad and right on the steering wheel, and this is what I had by the time I got to the graveside.
You work well under pressure, I guess.
I guess I had to. It was that or nothing at all.
Vance Gilbert, let's go out with Some Great Thing. We look forward to seeing you here in Iowa. Vance Gilbert will be performing this Friday night at CSPS in Cedar Rapids.
Thanks for your time.
If on a still, still day there's a stirring in the trees. Then you know some great thing is passed by here. If you hear a whisper as you pray on bended knees, then you know some great thing has passed by here. some great thing, the end of night, the daylight brings, some joyous, wondrous thing has passed by here. If your heart is laid down weary, but your soul still wants to sing, then you know some great thing has passed by here.
The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available by going to iowapublicradio.org. And we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Some great thing, like the end of night, the daylight brings. Some joyous, wondrous thing is passed by here.